commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we're privileged to have Major General Mark Slominski, the Mobilization Assistant to the Commander of Air Force Materiel Command. General Slominski brings a truly unique perspective to the table, combining his current strategic leadership role at AFMC with over 14 years of hands-on experience as a warranted administrative contracting officer with the Army Corps of Engineers, which gives him a deep understanding of the challenges and opportunities facing government acquisition today. Major General Slominski is here today to share his experiences in his current role while also reflecting back on his time with the Army Corps of Engineers and their unique warranting process for degreed engineers. We'll also be diving into a specific success story, the expedited restoration of a critical Air Force flying mission at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, a project that showcased incredible synchronization between acquisition strategy and execution. Welcome, Major General Slominski. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much, Rob, and really appreciate the team's participation in these podcasts. I think it's a great opportunity to kind of just have a dialogue and share questions and thoughts, encourage continued innovation in our contracting space, and look forward to this podcast today.
All right. Excellent, sir. Hey, I'm excited to dive into your dual perspective as both an enterprise leader at AFMC, as well as your experience as a seasoned ACO. So let's start off with your current role as the mobilization assistant to the commander. Now, I think for a lot of our listeners, the term mobilization assistant, and especially the acronym IMA for individual mobilization augmentee, might not be fully understood other than it's an indication that you're a reservist. Can you give us a little insight into your current role at AFMC and what that entails?
Sure, you bet. Happy to. Let me start off with a discussion about reservists in general as citizen airmen. And of course, we have our total force partners as well from the Guard. Specific to the reserves, you've got a few different statuses. So as you mentioned, IMA is part of the Individual Ready Reserve Program. That's kind of in contrast to our traditional reservist. If you're here at Wright-Patterson across the flight line, the 445th, or at other installations, you have traditional reserve missions. And in those cases, they're organized around wings and specific missions, airlift, fighter, et cetera. The IMAs are really forward deployed into the active component. And so the IMAs are in a position in which they're directly assigned to an active duty position. And in some cases, they would be there to be able to backfill should that active duty position be vacated for any reason. And in other cases, they're essentially available to provide that expertise that assistant airman can bring from that outside perspective. So an MA is kind of like an Uber IMA. MAs are what they would call a ready reserve individual member as they get into the general officer ranks. And so it does pivot a little bit. So mobilization assistant, similarly to an IMA, is assigned to an active duty principal, in my case, the AFMC commander. But if you think about the mobilization assistant piece, it's primarily organized around bringing resources to bear during crisis or during needs of the organization. So I've had a chance here at AFMC twice now to be able to support the DCOM mission, for example, doing duties normally associated with the DCOM in cases in which we had leadership transitions. That's been a bit unique, but an awesome opportunity to support the command. And if you look around the formation, we have 11 other mobilization assistants, and they're at the center levels as well as here at the headquarters AFMC staff. And in total, we have about 1,400 individual mobilization augmentees within AFMC, and that includes those that are supporting the U.S. Space Force, who we shepherd and care for as the supporting badge comm for the Space Force. So an exciting mission to support from a reserve perspective, and then when opportunities are there to be able to help out support from the active duty needs, we'll do that as well.
All right, sir. Excellent. No, thanks for that rundown. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your experience as an administrative contracting officer, specifically with the Army Corps of Engineers. So the concept of warranting degreed engineers is probably something many of our listeners aren't really familiar with. Could you walk us through that process to include maybe the background, the rationale, and the benefits of providing engineers with contracting warrants?
Happy to. me take a little bit of step back into my civilian career in general, the majority of which was in the Army Corps of Engineers, because I think it helps paint the picture of how this nests together into a capability. So after 6 years of active duty, I transitioned into the private sector, worked for an architect engineering firm in Boise, Idaho for several years, and intentionally separated, you know, anything that dealt with military matters from my civilian life. I was in charge of their retail mechanical engineering design section, provide a whole lot of insight and rationale into the business end of how infrastructure designs are done, as well as the construction support that takes place. You know, following that experience, I had a chance to come on board as an Air Force civil servant. And in that environment, especially in the infrastructure space, you have a clear partnership that's necessary, as it is in really any kind of program and delivery method, in which the contracting team and the owner's requirements owners and mission owner teams have to work together. And in that space, you end up in some pretty specialized areas of contracting expertise within the FAR, so specifically architect engineering and construction. So let that sink in for a minute as we think about the rationale that's been applied by other agencies, which includes the Army Corps as well as the Navy. And so in shifting over to the Army Corps of Engineers back in 2005 timeframe, I then kind of worked my way up from the project engineering level, in which you're focused on specific projects, to the resident engineer level, in which you're leading the team that's actually forward deployed to the location where the work takes place. And then in parallel to being a resident engineer, they have opportunities to become an ACO. It follows the same path as really any other contracting officer would follow in terms of the degree requirements for having a significant amount of business experience from your undergraduate or graduate degrees. It also follows the DAU pathway, in which we are achieving level two contracting certifications. And as that resident engineer, again, in these cases, you're kind of forward deployed to the location you work in. And for our contracting professionals out there, wherever you may be, odds are that there are resident offices at your locations that are either staffed by Navy or Army personnel. And so, you know, they're kind of remote from the mothership in the terms of their job is to administer the work that's already been awarded to be constructed. You know, back at the home office, the contracting officers are then allowed to focus on procuring and terminating, you know, two other key features that are necessary for expertise. And those contracting officers that are 1102s carry that with unlimited warrants based upon going further into the contracting certifications. But what that allows is that resident office, which is typically, you know, 10, 15, 20 people, maybe larger depending on the magnitude of the program, to have the ability to quickly adapt and address the construction challenges that come up. And so in the construction world, oftentimes when you run into a situation, what costs the most money isn't the technical solution for the problem that was encountered. It's the time it takes to get to a decision. The extended overhead cost of a construction contractor once mobilized can easily be in the tens of thousands of dollars per day. And so another rationale for having the warranted degreed engineers at those resident offices is to be able to handle those items and give immediate direction that's backed up by the contracting warrant. That could be a undefinitized contract action, for example, to keep progress moving while you work the definitization and the final negotiation and adjudication to get to a definitized contract action. It could be handling a different site condition. It could be handling a multitude of changes that suddenly become apparent. And so all of these things are very valuable because it allows, again, the primary office in contracting to focus on procurement and terminating. It also allows that PCO to stay in tune with the construction project by having direct communications on a recurring basis with the ACO. But the ACO is intentionally limited in their capacity. Dollar value is typically limited to $500,000 per change in terms of the absolute value. They're also limited to very specific clauses that are within their purview. And I mentioned a few of them already, different site conditions, changes, variations in estimated quantities as a few examples. And so it creates this pretty powerful partnership in which you have people that are really minded towards construction. They came from a background of doing construction, they were degreed in construction or engineering matters, and they're given a limited authority, but that authority is sort of just the right amount to maintain progress, to address issues that otherwise would lead to significant cost, especially the cost of time, and to kind of keep the entire machine moving so that you can continue to procure, you can administer, and then, you know, if necessary, you can have the home office work a termination action. Hopefully that helps for some context.
No, sir, that's great. And again, you can obviously see a lot of efficiency there. Again, certainly requires some trust, but it sounds like the checks and balances are in there with the DAU warranting process. So since then, Have you seen or maybe thought about other areas of government acquisition where maybe our CO workforce could be augmented by maybe warranting other than the traditional 1102 series? I'm thinking program managers, and I'm sure they would love the idea, but it seems like maybe our contracting workforce might be a little nervous with that approach. Any thoughts on that, sir?
Sure. Some thoughts. And obviously, that's a policy decision that goes through SAFAQ, so I'm not going to wade too far into that. It's a relatively deep water. I guess what I'd offer is just conceptually what I just described as to why you would go down that path and where it works well. You know, thinking about situations in which your volume of work and administration is significant, the specialized expertise necessary to administer it is significant. Again, in the infrastructure space, you know, you've got to have a deep understanding of two specific aspects of the FAR relative to architect engineering designs and construction, each of which have their own set of clauses and requirements. And then I think the other piece of it is, do you have a situation that's similar in which the time associated with the change or an issue is as important or maybe more important than the actual technical issue to resolve? So in general, looking across our portfolios, you know, I don't know that I'd see the weapon system acquisitions going in that path. Maybe there's some elements of that that could learn from that, but largely they already kind of do something like that in terms of leveraging DCMA. Several of the major weapon systems I've worked on, you know, the actual administration requirements flow back to DCMA in terms of managing the on-site quality assurance at the factory, managing the acceptances of the products. You know, I think what we'll find as we kind of move forwards is this aspect of where might it work? And in the case we've seen with the Navy and the Army, it does work fairly well in the infrastructure space. Whether or not it becomes something the Air Force adapts, we shall see. You know, the major programs that the Air Force does for infrastructure by policy, at least for the MILCON authorizations, go to the Army and the Navy. And so they get to leverage that model even without having to necessarily invest in the degreed non-1102s carrying warrants. But as the Air Force continues to tackle more and more large infrastructure projects, it may be something that's of consideration. And of course, there's a good framework out there to learn from in terms of best practices, as well as things that could be improved upon.
All right, sir. No, thanks for that insight. Again, I think it's a lot something a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with, might be a foreign concept to a lot of us. But no, a very excellent insight there. Thank you. And you supported a wide range of DOD and non-DOD customers during your time as an ACO. What were some of the key differences you observed in contracting processes and priorities across these different organizations? Were there any best practices you learned that were maybe we could adapt and apply across various agencies?
Sure. Yeah, I've had a chance to serve in several capacities in different services and certainly work with them all. You know, we've already covered in depth this concept about the warranting of non-degreed 1102, so I won't go into that any further. I think proximity and partnership with the contracting team and those that they serve is one area of thought, and it's always emphasized. A business advisor, those that are helping to make acquisition choices and helping to effectively administer the work, and you always have to maintain the adequate arm's length separation, so you don't have overdue influence of those that are sort of managing the mission of the operational need or the requirements need. But in general, the situations in which you can actually have kind of a co-location or continued emphasis on being part of the same mission is one area that I've seen some definite differences in. You know, I mentioned earlier my experience as a base level working in the Air Force as a civil servant. And in that scenario, you know, you had a lot of great expertise that was there in the contracting squadron that was focused on serving multiple different requirements, be it services or architect engineering, construction, you know, a whole array of different things happening around the installation. But that separation of squadron was also evident in some cases. You could have, you know, some situations it was extremely well nested and partnered, some situations, you know, quite frankly, there was some animosity between the two. And so that certainly leads to some challenges in the latter situation, because then you have to find the common ground as you kind of work your way across the organizations, but also through the chains of command. And what you don't necessarily want to do is have it kind of elevate to where a group commander or a wing commander has to be the person that's managing that dynamic. And so if I pivot that over to what I've seen in, say, the Navy facilities command, as well as the Army Corps of Engineers models, you know, in those situations, you would have maybe an 06 level command that has an essential responsibility that's kind of geographic in nature. It's a region in the NAFAC mindset. It's a specific either state or boundary in the Army Corps of Engineers aspect, or multiple states usually. And so the mission of those organizations is to deliver engineering solutions for the region they support. And then within that organization, you know, under that command structure, you've got a clear distinction of a contracting function who follow their acquisition authorities all the way up to a senior contracting officer and a head of contracting agency. So that arm's length separation's there. But that contracting officer is part of the corporate board and structure that's in that regional delivery organization. So there's a huge amount of partnership that takes place and sort of mission focus. And I guess I'd offer that's one perspective to think about is, to the extent possible, how do we leverage that? You know, there's also a natural aspect about looking at shared services in which you have multiple folks that can support multiple missions. So it's really not one size fits all, but I guess the main point is the nesting to the mission, the ability to have kind of that direct contracting expertise leveraged while also maintaining that effective arm's length relationship so you can have truly kind of independent and objective and for the best interest of the government contracting decisions being made.
All right, sir. Excellent. So in terms of best practices, now let's turn to this remarkable project at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. So you've described this as the most effective synchronization of acquisition strategy, contract formation, source selection, and construction execution that you've ever seen. Can you break down the specific elements that contributed to this exceptional synchronization? What were the key decision points, and how did you ensure alignment across all stakeholders?
You bet. Yeah, so again, for context, this was a situation a few years ago in which a long-since-built culvert system at Joint Base Lewis-McChord at McChord Field started failing catastrophically. So, you know, back in the day, as they had to expand the runway length to handle jet aircraft missions, they ended up crossing over kind of a pre-existing stream bed, and that stream bed had some metal culverts that carried it under the runway. The metal culverts lasted probably 25 years past their lifespan. But when they started failing in a big way, and sinkholes were emerging all around the airfield, right up kind of to the edge of it. So that led to an emergency declaration that shortened the length of the airfield and led to a lot of consternation and bringing in resources to handle this. It's a complex operating environment. So you've got an Army-led joint base with a significant Air Force mission that has some very unique aspects of what the C-17s do there that that only the C-17s and McChord can do. And so the urgency was evident, and the objective was, let's get the full length of the runway restored as quickly as possible. So a very, very apparent and compelling mission that we could all circle around. Mm-hmm. And so within the question you asked about, you know, what were some of the things that we used to sort of manage this project and what made it so effective? A few things. So one thought, you know, looking at the end state in mind, how do we get there? And so this is interesting because it ties into these act transformation discussions we're having, in which a schedule imperative is a primary driver, a performance imperative is sort of right there with it, and then a cost imperative is maybe the lagging aspect, but still important clearly, because all three had to come together. But having that clear operational date and the objective circling around an operational date was so valuable. And that's something that that I would encourage that we look at across all of our programs. You know, as we work our way through the acquisition transformation that's happening right now, you know, one of the most objective ways to get after that is to simply list what are the operational dates we've already committed to for that program, that project, that platform, and then which of those have a high likelihood of being able to be pulled to the left, you know, be delivered faster, and how would we do so? You know, that starts to lead to some really interesting discussions about act transformation, in which you can start to see a whole number of levers that could be pulled, but it's really kind of project or program by program. So back to the McChord project, there's this objective to return it as quickly as possible. And so in establishing what that date would look like, we chose one in partnership with the operating organization and set that as the target. We then worked away with the contracting team and said, how do we get to that objective and do so in a way that still leverages innovation of the industry, but kind of bounds it? So we talk a lot in our programs about owning the technical baseline. So what did the technical baseline look like for this project? Well, we knew that we wanted to build this new culvert system out of reinforced concrete. That would be much more long-lasting. It would provide high confidence that there'd be no more failures in the future. But there's a whole different variety of ways you can do that. I won't go into the details here, but you know, the point was the technical baseline was reinforced concrete. The how, the specific attributes, the specific system that was to be designed and constructed, leave that to the contractor's innovation. Of course, that puts you in this interesting pickle because you start to walk into a contract, which isn't all that unusual in the infrastructure space, which is the design build realm. You know, that's a situation that you give performance specifications and then you allow the contractors to essentially finish the prescriptive design and construct it. But we weren't quite sure exactly what they would build. And so another challenge you run into in infrastructure projects and really, I guess, any kind of program is variations in cost. And so the second part that we leveraged was the variations in estimated quantities part of the contract FAR that allows for that. You know, in the sort of the spectrum of firm fixed price to cost reimbursable, right sort of in the middle is a very interesting and valuable tool is this variations in estimated quantities approach. And so what that allows you to do is to go through the project. In this case, we had a whole lot of different things we knew the contractor would have to do, excavation, the reinforced concrete work. We knew that they would also have to deal with the PFAS contaminated areas, so they had to deal with pumping and treating of that. So imagine each of those items, and then we have an estimated quantity of work that they'll have to do in the millions of gallons for PFAS in the cubic yards of reinforced concrete. So you're listing these estimated quantities in specific unit quantities as to how much they will have to accomplish. For each of those, you have a baseline quantity, and then you also have an overrun estimate. And as you tally all those up on the CLIN, on the bid schedule in the contract line items, you end up having a total that's a fixed price contract because it's the summation of all the base elements and the variations. We also, because the schedule imperative put in their early completion incentive. And so in that form, we said, hey, contractor, when you come and propose on this, ultimately through a best value proposal that we received, tell us, you know, here's the date you must finish by. Tell us what date you plan to finish by based upon the tools, techniques, and means and methods you're going to use. And then for every day that you beat your own date, we'll pay you a certain amount. We end up working through the industry days to get a little bit of insight from the contractors as to how much per day would sort of make enough of a difference. They're a little cagey. They wouldn't give you the exact amount, but they would kind of indicate, hey, if you can get to where you're, you know, clearly within the profit margin or maybe even a little more, then it's going to make a difference. So ultimately, we decided on going $50,000 a day for a maximum of 30 days. So now you have a contract line item that says for every day faster that you finish on top of your own schedule, you'll get a $50,000 payment. And again, because that's been tallied in the CLIN schedule to be, you know, $50,000 times 30 days equals $1.5 million, you've got a fixed price element. So those pieces all came together into, as you mentioned, just this amazingly well-synchronized contract, because in a lot of ways, we were thinking about the end state in mind. We were working our way towards it, but we also set up the team that was going to administer the project for success. You know, when they ran into issues in the field that led to a situation where there's more millions of gallons of PFAS has to be treated, or the contractor's actual design solution is a little bit more concrete than another option would have been, the contract was already structured to handle that. And you didn't have to go through a process of doing an upward obligation or a reprogramming request. And then ultimately the project was successful in terms of delivering faster than the selected contractor schedule had indicated. That got the runway restored. And then it also allowed subsequent work that dealt with taxiways to happen after the runway had been restored. So again, you know, what performance objective is critical? The runway. When? By this date or sooner, what performance can be managed through risk? Well, we can deal with the taxiways as a secondary element. You know, it's interesting because even today it starts to nest into a lot of the imperatives we're looking at for access and transformation. So I'm sure that'll lead to some thoughts and questions out there. And if there's value in a future podcast specifically about that contract, I'd be happy to go through it. But ultimately, a very successful effort. And as I guess the final tagline to that, how that makes a difference. A few years later, actually about a year and a half ago, as I was working for the Sentinel program in my civilian capacity, we had to give a spin-up brief to the new three-star in charge of the Corps of Engineers, General Graham. At the time, General Graham was the deputy commander at Joint Base Lewis McChord, and his boss was General George, who is now the chief of staff of the Army. And what's kind of ironic is that, you know, the impression you can make on a senior leader can last a lifetime, and that can be a negative impression or a positive impression. But General George was so impressed with the effort to restore that runway, even though it was an Air Force mission at an Army base, and to do so ahead of schedule, which is kind of unheard of, that stuck with him, and you know, his enduring appreciation of what the contracting team, the engineering team, and the project managers could do has stayed with him all the way through his time now as the chief of staff of the Army. So each one of these projects makes a difference. It makes a difference to the operational user, and it makes a difference to the senior leader that benefits from it.
All right. Now, excellent story, sir. And again, I see why you can consider that the best synchronization of contract and execution that you've ever seen. Very impressive. So now let's shift back to your current role at AFMC. So how does your experience as an ACO inform your perspective on how contractors can best support AFMC's mission? What are some of the common pitfalls you see contractors falling into? And what advice would you give them to improve their performance and strengthen their partnerships with the government?
Yeah, great question. We certainly rely on our contracted teammates to deliver our mission. And that's in so many different avenues, whether it's the contracted teammate that's actually leading the weapon systems delivery or the infrastructure's design and construction, or the advisor and assistant services contracts that we rely upon. A whole litany of different contractors that are necessary for our mission execution. You know, I think a few of the things that are really valuable to think about from a contractor perspective, and again, in my time in the private sector, it was as a contractor, not to the government. So that's maybe just as relevant because it brings that business imperative into it. It's understanding and really being bought into the specific needs of the specific contract that you're supporting, and maintaining kind of this you know, this diligence about it. Don't become complacent. Don't become nested in you know, sort of believing that that it's yours forever. You know, I think you always want to maintain a little bit of a competitive edge towards your approach towards it in terms of the diligence that you're pursuing it. You know, what we certainly have seen in a lot of my experiences is that you know, eager contractor that comes on board and absolutely learns what the contract says, embraces what the contract says, execute to what the contract says. And then over time, there's a little bit of complacency, maybe it's human nature, but it kind of creeps in to where it feels like it's just kind of theirs forever. And of course, that's not the case. You know, each contract has a duration and time span. But, you know, to the extent possible, really kind of maintain that same enthusiasm you had when you first joined the team to deliver to the best of your ability. I'll also tell you a couple of the red flags I've seen in terms of managing contracts that would really stand out of my mind. And that involves subcontracting or relying on others that are outside your control for things that are essential to your success. And so, you know, if you're in the business of doing weapon system acquisition and delivery, or if you're in the business of infrastructure design and construction, there's certain elements of each that if you can self-deliver those, or you have high confidence partnerships with your subcontractors, that really gives you the power to ensure you can deliver your critical path. The more that those are leveraged to others or to those that you haven't worked with before, really the more risk the contractor has taken on. So if you're building a building or building an aircraft, you know, there's essential elements of those, you know, the structure, the propulsion, the ability for those things to meet their ultimate objectives that, again, the prime contractor is in a better position to either self-deliver those or certainly have proven subcontractors that can help deliver those. Otherwise, you can imagine how their critical path starts to become a risk. A couple other thoughts too, schedule. And so it's not that unusual that I come across contractors that are performing work in which they've essentially subcontracted their scheduling expertise. That to me is a red flag. The schedule is an imperative of delivering the project, you know, the critical path schedule, the network analysis that goes into that, the integrated master schedule delivery. You know, if those are things that as a government employee, you're hearing, well, we subcontracted that, we'll get the next update in a month. We're not quite sure what it shows yet, but we'll know when we get it. Wow, that's hard. It's hard to fathom because it kind of reduces your confidence that this contractor owns the schedule and is delivering the schedule. It's also a little hard to believe because, you know, in order to have achieved the work in the first place, there must have been some element of schedule that the contractor had delivered or developed on their own. So there's a few, you know, thoughts that I would offer if I was looking at this from a contractor lens. You know, being able to understand what is part of your critical path, which means understanding your schedule, owning your schedule, having direct equities and control to the extent possible over those critical path elements, and then just maintaining that enthusiasm throughout the project so that you're really just as dedicated to delivering it on the day that it's delivered or the day the contract ends as you were on the day that you got the contract.
No, excellent advice, sir. And again, I think your red flags are, you know, certainly warranted. Absolutely. So great advice there. And then in today's rapidly evolving technological landscape, how can the contracting process be adapted to maybe encourage innovation from contractors while still maintaining fairness, transparency, and accountability? Are there specific contract types, incentives, or approaches that you've found to be particularly effective in fostering innovation?
You bet. I gave some examples from the one project, and I think those are somewhat enduring. So in terms of the government owning the technical baseline, you know, have that deep understanding of what do you really mean by the technical baseline. And in some cases, that means a performance, or it means a characteristic, or it means an objective, an operational objective. And it may mean a little bit of a prescriptive solution, like we want something to be a sixth-gen fighter, which means it carries forth a radar cross-section. Or we want a piece of infrastructure to be built out of reinforced concrete, but allow the industry to then fill in the gaps and pieces. Okay, well, there's, you know, three or four different possibilities of achieving that in terms of a weapon system plan form or characteristics or of an infrastructure solution. You know, and that allows that continued use of the innovation that the contractors can bring with ensuring that you ultimately hit your objective, which was to deliver a specific capability. And I think as far as incentives, you know, we've talked about a few of those as well. What is it that motivates the contractor relative to the marketplace they're in? Some of those things might be cost for sure, you know, an early completion incentive, for example, or a performance incentive. But part of it might also be market share. And so we don't necessarily think about that as much, but an opportunity for a contractor to gain some market share or to grow for future abilities to develop their product, you know, that can be somewhat of an incentive as well. And so I think you're seeing some of the discussion about the acquisition transformation, looking at, you know, what would it mean for early investment so that a defense industrial based partner can grow capacity. That gives them a competitive advantage potentially in the future as they continue to develop their products. So I think it's really a program by program discussion about what does innovation look like, what's the technical baseline look like, and what does the incentive structure look like. And then I think the next piece is consistency. You know, by and large, the projects and programs that deliver the best are the ones in which, once you've kind of come to the decisions about those essential elements, the technical baseline, the incentive structure, the opportunities and objectives, and the operational needs and dates, stick to them. There'll be a lot of tendency to change things as you go, but I've always learned that there's value in having that conversation with your operational and mission owners to let them know where in the life cycle they are. You know, a lot of times they have to just trust their predecessor. If their predecessor was the one that established the requirements, trust the predecessor. Now your phase is to help shepherd it through the acquisition, and your successor's phase will be to help shepherd it through the test and EMD phase and milestone C and beyond. You know, there's a lot of tendencies in the military to kind of go back and modify what your predecessor already agreed to. So I do suggest that for senior leaders and SMLs and others, you know, have that conversation as your new stakeholders come on board, let them know where in the process they are. And I think that does help. In general, folks aren't trying to upset the apple cart. They want to get the capability in the hands of the warfighter. They may just not really realize where in the process they are and how their role is specific to the life cycle of that system's development.
All right, sir. Now, excellent advice for, you know, our acquisition workforce as well as our industry partners. So maybe one final piece of advice. What would you say to the young professionals who are just starting their careers in federal contracting? What skills, knowledge, and experiences do you believe are most critical for success in this field? And how can they best develop those attributes?
Sure. Well, I think the number one skill I'd offer, in addition to your certifications and training, you know, you really need to embrace those and create a solid baseline of understanding and capability. But in addition to that, whatever it is you're acquiring, get some experience embedded with that mission. And that, you know, when we used to build our individual development plans back in my civil service days, there's a tendency to focus those almost exclusively on courses. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. You need to take courses to gain certifications. You need to take courses in order to maintain continuing education. We also tried to make sure there was a detail or detail opportunities listed in there each year as well. And maybe that's a week. Maybe it's 2 weeks. Maybe it's a 48 hours. Whatever the right amount of time is. We would tend to use those details as kind of empathy tours, we call them. And so that would take the individual and say, hey, partner you up with an organization that you're supporting in terms of their mission delivery and go work with them for a period of time. And in that capacity, it doesn't even have to be a very significant effort in terms of the manpower or the documentation, right? It's sort of a detail that's formalized between two supervisors. So I offer that because I think the more that the contracting professional can not just understand sort of on paper what it is they're acquiring, but can understand how it's employed, what it's used for, what the operational imperatives are for it, the better they are in that capacity and capability. And then I think another piece is, try and maintain to the extent possible that deep understanding of flexibility in contracting. There's so many different fields and elements of being an expert in contracting, and you certainly grow that as you go throughout your career. And there'll be opportunities to specialize. There'll be opportunities to maintain a breadth. In general, my experience over time has been there's sort of a sweet spot there of both, where you have to have credible expertise and credible breadth, but you also have an openness to exploring and going into something you haven't worked on before. Maybe you've only done procurement and you'd like to do administration. Maybe you've only done administration and you'd like to do procurement. Maybe you've only done services and you'd like to do architect engineering. There's a lot of goodness there in terms of again, having an adequate depth and breadth. So I hope that helps for some advice, and great job by the team out there tackling this important mission.
No, excellent, sir. Again, depth and breadth, absolutely critical to our workforce, both young and old. So excellent stuff. Hey, General Slaninski, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and insights on the contracting experience. Your dual perspective as a leader and a former ACO is invaluable. This has been a great conversation, and I'm grateful you could join us. On behalf of the Contracting Experience podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you. Do you happen to have any parting shots or any words of wisdom for our podcast listeners?
Rob, I just really appreciate the chance to have a chat with the team here, and thanks for this initiative. I think it's a great way to just have a good dialogue and maybe spur some additional questions or thoughts. Certainly available if you receive any feedback from this to go into a deeper dive on any of the topics I covered. Always available too to just answer something by knock on the door or schedule something and send an email, whatever works best for you. I think the key thing to think about is the contracting team. Decades ago, the government decided we weren't going to build things ourselves, and so we've relied on contracting professionals for many decades now to deliver this mission. And it's really impossible to believe that we'd be able to do so without a high proficient, high capable, and very dedicated workforce. So keep up the great job powering the world's greatest Air Force.
Excellent, sir. Great way to wrap things up there. And as always, a huge thanks to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.